Hello and welcome to Routines and Ruts, the podcast about daily rhythms and the inevitable stumbles we encounter in our lives. I'm your host, Madeline Dore, and for more than half a decade, I've been asking people what their days look like, what they do, when they do it, how they do it, and I've recently bundled all of the insights into my first book, I Didn't Do the Thing Today. It's been a delight to hear from some of you readers, as well as listeners, and I'm so pleased to hear that reading the book has felt like listening to a wise friend, a relief. Someone said it was a big bear hug, thought-provoking. It's really great to hear that the words are resonating. And if you're interested in getting a copy but wanting to know a little bit more about the book itself, it's all about letting go of productivity guilt. So it looks at where this productivity obsession has stemmed from in our society. It doesn't say that productivity is all bad. It's just that how we've made it the measure of our worth can mean that we feel like we're never enough. And then the book goes into the various stumbles that we encounter when we make productivity the goal. So it looks at things like perfectionism, comparison, expectation. At the end of the book, it looks at what we can turn to in our days instead. So perhaps some alternative measures or things that we can expand in our lives. So as I mentioned in the last episode, I'll be answering your writing-related questions. But before I do, I will share a routine and a rut. Now, the routine. I'm going to borrow something from my very own book, which is this idea of cultivating delightful discipline. So much of the time we think, if only we could be more disciplined, imagine what we could accomplish. But the way that we can frame discipline sometimes is a very punishing view. We set really rigid rules, we make the expectations or the bar really high, we use punishment as a way to motivate us. But in many instances, this punishment, this rigidity, this difficulty that we create actually brings about a sense of dread, making it all the more harder to do the things that we want to do. And so as I speak about in the book, it's perhaps a better starting point to look at what delights us or how we can cultivate delightful discipline. So that is starting with enjoyment first, starting with fascination, starting with the thing that we're drawn to, the thing that we want to do. And by doing that, we actually have a better chance of continuing or sustaining or developing a practice, a discipline at something. The example that I turn to often is exercise. We can create a frame of dread, which would mean that we exercise because we want to change ourselves. We want to change our body. We want to look better. And that just creates a sense of punishment or failure when we don't accomplish that very rigid goal. Whereas if we look at it from a delightful discipline lens, we exercise because it makes us feel good, because it makes us have more energy or clarity or creativity. And so when I made that flip for myself and I looked at exercise as a way to feel better rather than look better, I found myself exercising more and becoming more disciplined with it as a result. So that's my little routine for you. As for a rut of the week, at the moment, for many people, myself included, it's a very ambiguous time. And there's still this sense that it can be difficult to move our lives along. It can be difficult to build new friendships. It can be difficult to make a move somewhere new. It can be difficult to pursue certain activities. And very much feeling that in myself, this itchiness to be doing something new, but actually finding myself in a string of Groundhog Days, I decided that I wanted to refresh my days by pretending that I was on holiday in my own suburb. So how could I enjoy the space that I'm in if I can't make the grand movements or grand changes to my life currently? And so I made a list of things that I would sightsee or eat or go to or do if I was on holiday. And so I went and got a bagel. I went and got an ice cream. I cycled to a popular cafe. I took new running routes at sunset. And it just refreshed my own little suburb for me and helped shake this rut of lamenting that I can't make big changes, but instead embracing the small good things and the small little changes I can make to my day. Now, thank you all so much for sending some questions in about the writing process, the book publication process. Some themes emerged, so I've bundled a few things together. And I wanted to start with more general questions. So general in the sense that they're looking more at what gets in the way of us starting something that we really want to do. So it could be a book project, or it could be writing, or it could be something else entirely. So it's quite broad and general, and perhaps stumbles that we all encounter irrespective of whether we want to write a book or not. So someone asked about advice for people who struggle with procrastination and self-sabotage, who feel incapable of reaching their potential. Now, I want to start here with procrastination and self-sabotage, because I think it's a really fine line at times. Procrastination, as I've spoken about many times, can actually be mislabeled and it can be misjudged. So we call something procrastination when actually it can be thinking, and it can be a really important part of any process is to actually have that time of letting yourself take in inspiration. So it might not look like you're doing anything, but you're actually allowing something to form. And procrastination can actually be a really enriching process, but can also be a sign that you might not be ready to do the thing yet and you still need to do more thinking about the thing. But it can seep over into self-sabotage, where you continually postpone doing the things that you want to do or living the life that you want to live because perhaps you don't feel worthy of that thing, or you're scared, or there's fear, or fear of rejection, or fear of criticism. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of not feeling good enough to do the thing and procrastinating so that you prove yourself true. And then perhaps in your own eyes, never reach your potential. Now, potential is a tricky one, because I think that potential can almost be an ever-shifting goalpost as well. And so it's difficult to even pin ourselves to a potential. And it can be something that we're forever chasing, like ambition or success. And so I want to be careful with potential. But I think that at the core of this message is really about courage. So those that perhaps push through procrastination or break out of self-sabotage or work towards at least stepping towards a potential really have these moments of courage. And courage is an interesting thing, because we assume that people are just courageous or not courageous, but actually courageous can be really reinforcing, self-reinforcing. It's similar to confidence. So you're not born confident, you become confident after experiencing something. And so you need the experience, and that experience often opens you up to failure and making mistakes. But those mistakes and failure actually lead you to learning, and that learning enables you to do the thing differently again when you have that experience and improve upon it, and improving upon it leads to more confidence. And with more confidence, you have more courage to try things again. And so it becomes this beautiful snowball. The courage wasn't necessarily there to begin with, but it was cultivated. So sometimes we're not looking for this big courageous act, we're just looking for something small that will nudge us into that experience and then set off that snowball. So I think that's my advice for this question, is that find that small thing that can nudge you into beginning. And that helps address the procrastination, because procrastination, it's so much easier to just wallow in it than start the thing. But if you make the thing small and just nudge yourself into it, perhaps you'll have a better chance. And then it's that the momentum is the only thing that will lead you to that potential. Now, a related question was this idea of feeling worthy. So someone asked, how does one get past, over, or break through the invisible barrier of not feeling worthy to do something? Others have more worth, better stories, better lives, better talent, better routines. Who am I to want to do something similar? I'm not as important, capable, dedicated, smart, talented, etc. Why try? I'll probably fail anyway. Example, I have stories to write and I don't because of all these reasons I mentioned. So I really appreciate this question, because I think it does speak to this idea that we assume that people have confidence or courage, that people have better stories to tell, better lives, better talent, better routines. That's definitely what drew me to starting to ask people in the first instance for my project, Extraordinary Routines, I was absolutely comparing myself to other people and assuming that they had better routines, better lives, and I needed to understand the secret. And once I had the secret, then I could replicate it and then I could feel potentially worthy enough to do something. But what I realized instead when I got up close to these people that I admired and thought had better lives and better routines and all of those things is that they too feel like that. They also experience procrastination and self-sabotage and self-doubt and not feeling worthy enough or not knowing what to do in dull moments and feel like they're in ruts and all of those things. It's very human. And so when it comes to looking at how do you break through that barrier of not feeling worthy, is that you have to really internalize this idea that someone else doesn't hold the secret. Someone else doesn't have a recipe for feeling worthy enough, and someone else isn't going to give you permission to do those things. Again, it's like confidence. You will feel confident once you have started to have the experiences that, and then make the mistakes and learn from those mistakes and cultivate confidence and then the courage. And so these two questions sort of meet each other beautifully in that you need to find that nudge. Interestingly, what I did take away from speaking to people that I admired is that, yes, they experience self-doubt. Yes, they procrastinate. Yes, they doubt themselves. Yes, they question decisions. But there's a small glimmer of knowing that it's up to them. I'm reminded of this beautiful quote by Neil deGrasse Tyson, who said, "The most successful people recognize that in life, they create their own love. They manufacture their own meaning. They generate their own motivation." So this speaks to everything. Other people are only going to be able to take you so far or encourage you so much or believe in you so much. It really is up to you to have that sense of worth. The worth isn't going to come from outside you. The worth and validation isn't going to come when you share the work or when you progress. It's going to have to keep on building inside of you. And it comes and goes. I remember I was at a party and I met this lovely new friend, and we were talking about this idea of creativity and courage once more. And we were talking about how we're all lost in a sea of self-doubt. Like, that's kind of the default position, perhaps because of how a consumerist society has been built to really zero in on our lack and convince us that we need to fill it with external things and aspirational routines and love and validation from others and success and busyness and all of these things. So we're all swimming in it together. We're swimming in it in a society that might even be creating more waves. And yet we're each trying to get to the island of self-worth where we can do the things that we want to do in this life. But we have to make our way through this sea. And that's where I think it's important to note that this looks a little bit different for everybody. We all experience different waves and different intensities of those waves. We each have varying circumstances, privileges, opportunities, education. Some people might be thrown far more lifeboats early on in life. And that links back to this idea of confidence. Maybe it appears to be an innate trait for some because they were given experiences and opportunities much earlier on and perhaps given a safer environment to make mistakes and to build that experience and confidence and therefore courage. They have more of a safety net to take risks. And so again, it's very important to look at these differences and these waves, and perhaps that we're all in this sea of self-doubt societally, but we also have different modes and different opportunities to get to the islands of worth, of self-worth. And I guess that's another thing, is that what we feel we're worthy of also looks different, or what we aspire to. Maybe some of us don't want to swim out to the island. We just want to be on the shore, or maybe we want to ride the wave on a surfboard, or maybe we want to build a little raft out of whatever we find. But I think what's important to note is that it comes and goes. This idea of being on the shore, being on the surfboard, being on the raft, we're going to be continuously thrown off and on the course of self-worth and pursuing the things that we want to do. And so perhaps the difference with those that have taken hold of something that they want to do is simply that they're aware for that moment that they're on the shore or they're on the island or they've got hold of the raft, that they have it. And so that they can use what they have and create something with it instead of waiting for someone else to tell them that they're worthy. They're aware and they build that sandcastle now that they're on the island, knowing that the shore will come and it will be swept away again by the sea of self-doubt. This made a lot more sense at the party, but I hope it's translating to something now, because I think that the point is really that we're swimming in self-doubt, but that doesn't mean that you are any less worthy than anybody else to swim to your own little island and do the things that you want to do. Because just by default, you are. It's not your failing that you're in this collective sea of self-doubt that we're all swimming in. The most disheartening question is, why try? Why try? Because why not try? Why try because of what you might discover? Why try because of what you might learn? Why try because of how it might refresh your days, who it might lead you to meeting, what it might help you discover in yourself? Why try? There are a myriad of reasons why you should try. You can gain so much from trying. You can save yourself by trying to swim to the shore. If you're just flailing in the sea of self-doubt, not much happens there. So why try? Because it might lead to something. It might not. You might not get to the shore, but at least you tried. I think we're afraid of trying because we might look bad, but we don't realize that we look bad by not trying. We worry that it will be a waste of time, not realizing that we're wasting our time worrying about it being a waste of time. It just perpetuates the failure. So instead of having this question of, I'm not sure where this might lead, that's a question, you've turned it into a guarantee of this not leading anywhere because you're not moving it anywhere. I hope that you enjoyed swimming around in those metaphors. We've got the snowball of confidence. We've got the sea of self-doubt and the two sort of interlink in a really interesting way. So make of that what you will. Now, I wanted to move through to some questions that are specific to publishing a book. So those of you who are interested in publishing a book, these might be helpful. One of the questions was about when or how did you realize it was ready to be a book? And I just like to say up top that it was a really long process in knowing when it was ready. This book went through several iterations and several proposals over several years. And so I had started my project Extraordinary Routines in 2014. I was approached by a couple of different publishers who were interested in sort of turning the blog, the interviews, into a coffee table book. So that would have meant beautiful photography and the interviews sitting alongside that. That didn't quite feel right. It didn't resonate. It just felt like pressing print on the blog and putting it into a book. And as someone who had fancied themselves a writer, I wanted to write a book. I didn't want to just press print. It's obviously a lot more complicated than that, but that was behind the decision. In saying no to that offer, it really alerted me to this fact that I did want to write a book, but I needed it to be thematic. And so I sat with the interviews and I kept exploring the topic. I kept speaking to different people and I was starting to just observe what themes were emerging. And for a little while, I thought the book would focus solely on time. So I started to collect everything about time. For a little while, I looked back at, well, what really drove me to start this project? And as I mentioned just earlier, it was comparison. So maybe this book is all about comparison. And I explored these topics extensively. I wrote proposals for them. I sent them to publishers. I even spoke with a publisher and they said, great, really love this idea that you're exploring about comparison. Can you write a sample chapter and we'll talk again? 2 years later, no sample chapter written. I'd told friends about this book and how I'd met with a publisher and I was like, yeah, I'm just working on this book proposal. Never happened. I'd attempt it. I'd tell people about it. I'd try to have accountability, but I procrastinated. I put it off. And I sincerely believe that this is one of those cases where procrastination was doing me a favor because – that's not the book that I was wanting to write. There was more to it, and I had to sit with it for longer, and I needed more themes to emerge. I think to answer the question here, I decided to be patient with this process. I could see that I was putting it off. I could see that it was procrastination, but I really felt that it wasn't sabotage, this instance. It was, this isn't ready yet. I'm going to put it to the side and allow it to form. And then interestingly, months and months later, it really was this epiphany, this little limerick or poem, whatever you'd like to call it, came to me, and I wrote it down, and there was a line from that little poem that then formed the initial title of the book. And having that frame, I returned to the proposals I'd written, I re-cobbled them together, and I wrote this proposal in a morning. It just flowed out of me, and the book was ready, in that I'd finally landed on the idea and it felt right and it poured out of me. I then returned to the publishers I'd been speaking with this, and then from there started the publication process, which I'll go into a little bit more in a moment. So I think to answer the question of when does it feel ready to be a book, when it just feels ready, when it comes from you, that was my experience. Maybe it's different just depending on your goal with the book. Maybe for you, having the press print on a blog or another project is the book. Maybe that feels ready. Maybe that's what you want to accomplish. But for me, there was more to the process that I wanted to explore. And that's the beauty of it. Writing a book is the process. It's not the publication part so much. There's so much work that goes into it that you have to enjoy that process part. So related from there is the next question about how do you get to a point where you have the resources and support to write and distribute a book? I'm curious about your writing journey so far. So there's a few questions in that question. In terms of just a quick summary of my writing career, I studied journalism and a few other things and went down a meandering, winding path, and then found myself back at journalism, really wanting to pursue that. And I was finding it very hard to break into the industry and find a job. And so I was doing different work in a gallery and cobbling together an income, and at the same time started Extraordinary Routines as a way to build a folio, but also demystify the creative process and how people build careers. And so that project was something that then landed me a job as a full-time arts journalist. I then have worked freelance. When things are slowing down, I often turn to full-time work in content writing. Alongside all of that, I am picking up and putting down labors of love. So Extraordinary Routines kept on going in a very ad hoc way when I had the time and attention and curiosity for it. But that meant that was the book idea bubbling away in the background. Then to write the book, I had to finally find the right frame, as I just discussed. And then I worked on the proposal. And as I mentioned, I sent it to the publisher. So I sent it to an Australian publisher, and they took it, they were interested, so they took it to a sales meeting, and then after the sales meeting came back with an offer. Once I had that offer, I actually reached out to an agent, and we did this very complicated thing where we split off the US North America rights, and I landed a US deal as well. So essentially getting two book deals, which gave me the financial support to write the book. And the publishers then take care of the distribution of the book. That's how it works with publishers, is that you are offered an advance if it's nonfiction, and that gives you time to write the book. Those advances differ wildly, and so people cobble it together very differently. Sometimes people work full-time alongside writing a book. Sometimes people self-publish, and so that would then introduce a whole new suite of questions about distribution. But I hope that I can speak to my experience there in terms of being able to write the book by living off the advance. So another question that was book related is, how did you get an agent? Now, I want to take you back to many, many years ago when I got my first agent. So this was when I was working on different proposals, speaking with the publisher and looking at these ideas but procrastinating on them. At that time, I was reaching out to agents as well. And so how I approached that was looking at the writers that I admired and going to the acknowledgement sections of their book and finding their thank you to their agent. Once I had that, I found their email and I sent them an introductory email just sharing who I was, linking to any writing and projects very briefly, and synopsis of the book idea, the pitch. I heard back from a couple of people and I actually signed with an agent at that time because they were interested in the idea that I had. they too wanted to see a sample chapter, and we'd had some conversations about what that would look like, and enter Procrastinating for 2 years. That agent moved on and decided to become a different type of agent, so I was left with no agent. So I procrastinated through an entire agent, you can say. But I kept thinking. Then when I got the Australian offer that I just mentioned, then I reached out to a new agent and explained that I had an ambition to split off the rights. They were really into this idea, and so I signed again with another agent. We continued the process from there. So I suppose that illuminates a couple of ways to approach this, is that you can have the offer and then approach an agent who can help you negotiate that offer, or you can cold email agents with an introductory email, a query letter, and go from there. And that can be a long process, but it really is about researching agents that you would look to work with and maybe having a chapter sample ready so that you don't procrastinate on it for 2 years like I did. Now to turn to some writing process questions. Caveat, I'm all about people finding their own way. That's what the whole book, I Didn't Do the Thing Today, is all about. So please take this process with a grain of salt and experiment with what appeals, but know that your process and your approach is the best approach. So the next question is, how do you organize and sift through all of your interviews and findings to find a chapter or theme? Now, to answer this specifically for the book, I used an app called Milanote. So it's a Melbourne startup and it's spelled Milanote. I did some work for them. As I mentioned, I do different content writing jobs, and I just fell in love with the tool. So I'm not sponsored by them, but I will get very excited in this next little spiel. But Milanote is a combination between Evernote and Trello, and it has complete flexibility. So there's not sort of rigid columns like you might find in Trello, for example. Instead, there's this infinity canvas where you can move everything everywhere. In Milanote, you create a board, and in that board, you can create another board, or you can create a column, you can create little notes, you can add videos, you can add web clippings, you can add images, text, you can do little diagrams and have arrows, you can move things around completely. And so this was perfect in terms of my book writing process, because I had my extensive book proposal and I knew what the chapters were. And so I created the chapters in columns. And then what I did is reread the entire Extraordinary Routines archive. And as I was going through each interview, I would pull quotes from those conversations and I would then categorize them into a column depending on the theme. So if I knew it was something that was fitting for the perfectionism chapter, I'd put a quote and the person's name in that column. And so those columns became quite unruly and messy, but that's the beautiful thing about Milanote, is that it takes something from being quite messy and how your brain works, and then you can do the organizing part later. And so the same thing was with any research that I'd done in terms of articles or book quotes or other conversations. I just started to categorize the archive into those columns. Now, once I'd done that, I organized them a little bit more, neaten them up, because that's always nice to do. And then you can export the column into a Word document. And I found this incredibly helpful for a book writing process, because I pressed export and I no longer have a blank page. I have a page, pages filled with my own research and quotes and themes emerging from that chapter. And so it just meant that to start writing, I just started to organize those notes and organize that archive. For me, that's always been how I've written articles and things, is just having things on the page and almost starting to do a jigsaw puzzle to arrange them. And so that was a great way to kind of get over the block or the fear of a blank page, because it just wasn't blank. And that is a nice segue in many ways to the next question, which is, where on earth do you start? I understand writing a book is a pretty huge task. How do you reach the goal of writing a book? I think there's already some lessons emerging from what I've already said, and one of them being, allow things to take the time that they take. Don't judge the procrastination, because maybe it's leading you somewhere and it's actually thinking time that's going to help you really clarify what that book is. And this lesson about engineering a way to avoid the blank page. So that to me was a really helpful way to start, But it just depends, where is the start? Is the start when I started Extraordinary Routines, or is it when I started the proposal, or is it when I started a chapter? Is it when I started the research? Is it when I started writing? There's so many different starting points. And so in many ways, with the writing process or any creative process or living day to day, we start anew each day. And each new start can be a struggle in that there can be resistance. And what I encountered with the book writing process is that some days just aren't desk days. I might have said, okay, I'm going to just write all day today, which is always a dangerous thing to say to yourself because it makes the task of writing far too daunting. But some days just, it was a day to actually be out walking, thinking, making connections in my mind. And so I've started to embrace those days and see that it wasn't a desk day. Sooner or later, after enough walks, there comes a time when you need to do the writing. The book needs to be written. And so there are clever little tricks that I have, again, that work for me, and you can absolutely experiment with them. But I do tend to work in 45-minute spurts. And so in my book, I speak about this as puddle theory and really making the big overwhelming task of writing a book just one small puddle. So be that editing one page in 45 minutes or one paragraph even. And so for the book writing process, I listened to one song every single time I was writing the book, which is Ambient Chopin by Peter M. Murray. And the song goes for 22 minutes and 30 seconds approximately. So listening through it twice is a 45-minute session. And so I found that really helpful because after a while, it signaled to my brain, hey, this is writing time, that song's playing. And so I can highly recommend that as the little trick. And just keeping the little work sessions short was really great for my brain. So I like to have that focus time for 45 minutes and the break. I also found it really helpful to work with other people, so both virtually and in person, just for that extra bit of accountability, but also to make it fun. So it can be really great to have a shared goal with somebody and to be working alongside each other, cheering each other along, and makes those breaks really energizing, but it also keeps you focused in those work sessions as well. Again, this circles back to this idea of wanting to do it, to want to write the book. And wanting to write the book means embracing the non-desk days. Again, as I speak about in my book, I am a sponge. I have a lot of absorbing time. I think I'm a very, in many ways, my creative process is quite slowed in that absorbing part. But then when I'm ready to do the work, it is this quite intense squeeze. So I could have 4 days that are not desk days, and then I could have one day that is a huge 16, 18 hour day, and it's squeezed out of me. And I could judge myself for that process. I could call it inefficient. I could call it exhausting. I could call it lazy. But enough times around, that is the process. And in the end, it resulted in the book being written. So perhaps embracing that and planning for that is actually the best approach. So I think, again, it comes back to these central lessons that we keep on learning, which is to start is to make it small, is to make it fun, to want to do it. I think that's the key. And even in wanting to do it, there'll be days that you don't want to do it. There were definitely days where I thought I wasn't ever going to be able to finish this book. But then you have these flashes of being proud of the book. And there's so much in there that encompasses these very lessons that I encountered. So I lived the book as I wrote it. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things to do with any project, is to live it while you're writing it, to let it be of you and of your life. And really, we're doing these things at the end of the day to fulfill us. And so that can make it a lot easier to begin as well, because it's no longer about whether you're worthy or whether it's going to be successful or whether it's going to have a claim. It's about whether you want to do it. Do you want to swim to that little island and see what's there? Do you want to build a sandcastle on that little island instead of swimming in the sea of self-doubt? It's okay, we're going to be in the sea of self-doubt, but when we see the little islands that we fancy, sometimes it's worth trying to get there. So I hope that that's been helpful. As always, it's just been a delight to share with you, and thank you for listening to this episode of Routines and Ruts. Thank you for asking your questions. I'll do a couple more of these episodes, so if you want to ask a question, you can visit madelinedoor.com/ask. And You can also find copies of my book in all good bookstores and online. There's a link in the show notes as well to where you can find that. And the chapters delve even further into so many of the things that we've just discussed about discipline and perfectionism and comparison. And really, the book is a permission slip to find your own way. So talk soon. And until then, I hope you remember there's more to the days than what we do or don't do. So we may as well find a way to enjoy it.